Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. Canada has come a long way when it comes to understanding and acceptance of the spectrum of sexuality, but I think that we'd all admit there are still places, usually behind closed doors, where the question of whom we can love is still policed, either directly or indirectly. Today we're going to talk about some of those places. You may have heard the term conversion therapy. If you have, the image it conjures up might be a disturbing picture of religious groups aggressively trying to force someone's sexuality into line with their own beliefs. That does happen, and it is tragic, but there's also another, more insidious type of this therapy, one in which the recipient freely requests the treatment, and the issue of consent is murky at best. And that kind of therapy is being offered all over Canada right now. And today, we're going to take a peek at what happens behind those closed doors. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Megan Jones is a journalist and editor at Reader's Digest and a freelancer for Les Spread the Word. Megan, first of all, because the terms are kind of interchangeable, tell me, what is reparative therapy?
So, simply put, reparative therapy, or conversion therapy, as I think a lot of people know it, is a pseudoscientific practice of attempting to change a person's sexuality or their gender identity.
To get a sense of what this actually looks like for people who go through it, tell me the story of Andrew Perrin.
Andrew Perrin is a young man in his mid-20s. He lives in British Columbia. And about 7 years ago, he started to go through a version of conversion therapy. So Andrew grew up in an evangelical community. Religion was very, very important to him and to his family. And he started to experience crushes on boys when he was a teenager. And when he got a bit older, he sort of had a crush that was quite significant, and he started to think that he wanted to sort of explore what that meant and realize that he needed to change something about himself if he wanted to stay within his community. So he spoke to a friend of his who had also experienced same-sex attraction, a woman, and she mentioned that she knew someone at her church who had had crushes on men before, but was ultimately married to a woman. And she said, maybe this guy can help you.
So Andrew was seeking out this kind of therapy. It wasn't forced on him.
No. So, and his sort of experience is similar to what I think a lot of adults experience. We see conversion therapy. We think about it as this thing that maybe teenagers get forced into by their parents.
Yeah, that's certainly the popular myth of it, for sure.
And you see that a lot in movies, and I think that's kind of the benchmark that we have for it. But what I realized when I was researching is that a lot of people, like Andrew, actually self-initiate because they feel that if they don't, they'll be forced out of their communities, or they feel shame, or they feel guilt about their sexuality. And so they take these steps to try to change something about themselves in order to better fit in or to sort of feel more comfortable. So Andrew went and spoke with this church leader, and at their first meeting, they sat down. The leader drew this diagram of a tree, and he was labeling a bunch of different parts of it. And he said, the fruit is your attraction to men, but the root is something called homo-emotional need, and that's caused by a lack of healthy male relationships in your childhood. And he basically told Perrin, if you start identifying with men and bonding with them in a healthy way, then your homo-emotional need will go away. And it's only there in the first place because you didn't bond well with men growing up, whether it be your father or your friends.
Healthy in this case, I guess, meaning non-romantic.
Non-romantic, exactly. And at first, this wasn't something that Perrin bought. He was like, this doesn't really make sense. But it was so important to him to understand why his feelings of sexual attraction to men and his feelings about faith couldn't coexist. So he kept on meeting with this guy. And that's really how it started.
And what form would those meetings take after the initial consultation? And what did they urge him to try to do in his life? And how did he go about it? Because I'm fascinated by what they would actually require of someone who was going through this and how they propose to get results.
One of the most interesting things about this is that when you talk about it, it sort of seems like nothing happens. It's not as dramatic as we expect it to be. So for him, it was meeting with this guy at first once a week and then later a couple of times a month. And mostly they just talk. So this man was a high school teacher, and he would say, "I'm sometimes attracted to the students at my school, and that makes me feel horrible." And, you know, Andrew would say, "I have a crush on a boy that I know, and that makes me feel awful." And they would sort of just talk about these things and commiserate, and they would share long, intentional hugs with one another, and they would just bond in a way that they felt was healthy because it was platonic. So it's a lot of talking when you're meeting, but that's mostly it. And then on his own, Andrew was encouraged to do things like bond with more men. So he cut off a bunch of female friendships in his life, which left him quite isolated. Or he stopped watching Glee because that's what was on at the time. And that was sort of the queer media that you could consume. And he didn't date, and he didn't hook up, and he didn't masturbate. And he just sort of, you know, denied all of the parts of himself that could have been connected to queerness at all.
And did that work?
Absolutely not. I think the consensus is that this kind of therapy doesn't work for anyone. And certainly in his case, it didn't either. It ended up leading him to feel extremely depressed, isolated, carrying a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. And eventually that led to a breakdown. And that's sort of when he started to realize that what he was going through wasn't actually supportive and it wasn't compassionate. It was manipulative and gaslighting and quite harmful.
Are there any regulations around this kind of therapy in Canada?
There are, but it's sort of patchwork. So there are four different areas that restrict the practice. It's not quite correct to say that it's banned because it's not a full ban. So Ontario and Nova Scotia and Manitoba have sort of restrictions on conversion therapy. So in Ontario, for example, it's illegal to offer it to anyone under the age of 18. And OHIP funds can't be used to pay for it in adults. Similarly, in Manitoba, the health regulation there prevents fee-for-service professionals from billing the practice under the province's health services plan. The city of Vancouver is a bit more comprehensive, so it prohibits businesses, including religious groups that charge a fee, from providing services intended to change a person's gender identity or sexual orientation. Hmm. But even these things leave a lot of room. For example, in Ontario, if a group provides reparative therapy to an adult for free, they are unaffected by the law because they're not billing it back to the province and that person is an adult, so they're not covered by these regulations.
Up next.
A lot of time was spent just praying for me over the phone.
What happens when you pick up the phone and ask for this therapy? Megan will tell us. There's a trader in all of us. Direct invest with Scotia iTrade. Become a new client and you could get up to $1,500 cash or 300 free trades when you open and fund a new account. Conditions apply. See ScotiaiTrade.com for details. What kind of research exists around this therapy and whether or not it works or the harm that it causes?
In Canada specifically, there isn't a ton, but many researchers have shown that telling a person that they can or should change their gender or sexuality can have long-term effects, and that can include things like substance abuse or chronic depression or difficulty forming relationships if you're always told that you should be ashamed of the people that you love. And we've seen that suicide rates among LGBTQ youth are quite high, especially when they don't have affirming care. But on the flip side, you see that when especially young people receive care that is affirming, they grow up to be healthy and well-adjusted and happy. And the difference is just striking.
Do we have any idea how often this happens or how many places offer it, either in Canada or elsewhere in the world, to get a sense of? Because one of the things that blew me away about your piece was it's something that I associate with, you know, the bad old days. And to hear it still going on is a little startling.
Yeah. So we know that in the States, we have solid numbers because there was a 2018 study that was conducted by UCLA's Williams Institute. And what they found is nearly 700,000 LGBT adults have been subjected to conversion therapy. So to put that into perspective, that's like the population of Boston or almost twice the population of Halifax. It's a lot of people. Researchers for the same study also found that they felt that an additional 57,000 youth would receive this so-called treatment from a religious advisor before they reached adulthood. So it's no small thing. In Canada, unfortunately, as with most things, we don't have comparable numbers. And it's really hard to track here because it is happening in the shadows. You can't really rely on survivors either to come forward because so many people leave this kind of treatment traumatized or feeling shame, and they don't necessarily want to talk about it. Finding people to go on the record for the story was incredibly difficult for that reason.
Well, it's also interesting that there is this push afoot to restrict it completely because when it comes to adults, at least, it seems like it would be really difficult to police something that people are, as I didn't know, but as the story of Andrew illustrates, that people are openly requesting and that organizations are providing for free and not registering with the healthcare system.
Yeah, it does become almost impossible to track or to police. And I think that that's why a lot of activists who are pushing for formal laws are focusing on minors or focusing on healthcare providers that are billing back to the province, because that's really the only way that you can enforce it. You can't tell an adult what they can and can't do. One important thing to remember when we're talking about self-initiation, though, is that even though technically it's consensual in that an adult puts themselves in that situation, a lot of the things in their life have brought them to there. So they're experiencing shame, they're experiencing guilt, they're worried about being ostracized from their community. They've been told over and over and over again that what they're doing is wrong or evil or impure. And so they feel like they have no choice. And that isn't necessarily consent, I don't think.
Now, this is not me asking from a point of view of, you know, what the church does when they do this is evil, but where does the impetus for this come from? Because if it's not working and it's producing harm in the people it's intended to help, what is the point of continuing to do it? I don't see where anybody benefits.
That's the thing. My impression from having called a bunch of places myself is that people really do feel like what they're doing is helpful.
Yeah.
Conversion therapy doesn't really get framed as it used to. So a lot of people will say, they won't say, being gay is bad and we will change you, or being trans is bad and we will change you. They will say, we are compassionate sites. We see that you're suffering and we want to help you change that. So they frame homosexuality or gender nonconformity as things that cannot be necessarily changed, but weakened over time if you suppress them enough. So when you call places, they'll say, hey, we're here to help you. We want to help you out. And they feel, I think, that what they're doing is right. It's extremely misguided and it does not work. But I think that a lot of people who are offering these services really do think that what they're doing is going to be helpful.
What happened when you called those places in general? How did you find out about it first? How did you figure out where to call?
So you don't realize how common these things are until you start really digging into them, because they'll masquerade using different language. Again, no one says, yes, we offer conversion therapy. No one is really ever going to advertise themselves that way. They'll say things like, we will help you to achieve sexual purity, or we will help you break your sexual bonds, or we will help you overcome your struggles. So once you understand that and you start looking for that kind of language, you realize that there are just dozens of places across the country that are doing this kind of thing. So I was looking around on different websites. Often people will link to each other. A lot of activists keep lists of places that they think are doing conversion therapy or know are doing conversion therapy. I phoned one ministry in Ontario, and I spoke with a representative there for 45 minutes over the phone. And he asked me questions about my background, sort of why I was calling, how long I had been experiencing same-sex attraction for, why I wanted to change. And then a lot of time was spent just praying for me over the phone. And I was told that if I wanted to continue, somebody would come to my house and we would start these sessions in my home, which is not something that we ended up pursuing.
What was it like to have that conversation about how long you've been having same-sex attraction and what you'd like to do about it and how you could control it, even though you had obviously no intention of going through with the therapy? What are those conversations like?
It feels very confusing because the person on the other end of the line does seem genuinely compassionate. Like, I remember phoning, and the tone of voice that people will use feels so similar to when I was looking for just, you know, regular therapy at a different point in my life. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of kindness and softness and understanding. And I mean, I am very secure in my sexual identity, so that wasn't right. a problem for me. But I could just imagine that if I was suffering and if I was feeling alone and confused and vulnerable, that would probably have seemed quite comforting to me. Really, it throws you off.
Are there any resources in the LGBTQ community or elsewhere, for that matter, organizing against this or trying to help people who are vulnerable to the kind of service these people are offering?
Yeah, there are a number of groups. It really depends where you are. So there's a group in Alberta called Why Queer L that is really pushing to have this banned. They're actually behind a formal petition to the Canadian government to have it banned to minors federally, which is circulating right now. In Quebec, there's a group called l'Alliance Arc-en-Ciel de Québec, which was investigating conversion therapy in the province. Groups like EGAL are, you know, very staunchly against conversion therapy. Again, it's a bit ad hoc, but I think most major LGBTQ plus organizations are aware and are very, very against it, and will help to provide people with resources if they're approached.
You mentioned a petition to ban it Canada-wide, at least to minors. How often does this issue actually come up in federal politics, and is there a chance we'll be hearing more about it this year with the election?
So far, it doesn't seem to have been something that gets discussed very often. I think that a lot of politicians don't necessarily understand that it's still an issue. I mean, I was shocked to learn that it was happening as much as it is. And I think there are a lot of petitions who would also, or politicians rather, who would be in the same boat. When we contacted the special advisor to the Prime Minister on LGBTQ plus issues, Randy Boissonneau, he declined to be interviewed. So I don't really have a sense of how much this is on the government's radar. That said, there are new laws coming up. You know, Nova Scotia just passed a bill. Alberta has one tabled. People are talking about this issue more. So it would really be nice if it did become an election issue. Whether or not it will, I'm not sure.
How's Andrew Perrin doing now?
He's doing much better. I mean, there will always be, you know, with any traumatic situation, you're going to have lasting effects. So he still, you know, struggles with things like internalized homophobia sometimes, or shame, or dips in self-esteem. But these days he is living in a new city. He's got a boyfriend who actually also survived conversion therapy. So together they're sort of working through these things. They're starting to make more queer friends, and he's really embraced this part of his identity and is doing much, much better.
Thanks, Megan.
Thank you so much.
Megan Jones, journalist, editor at Reader's Digest, freelancer for Les Spread the Word. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And you can visit frequencypodcastnetwork.com to find the latest episode of The Big Story, but also to find our new podcast called Three Trips Ahead, hosted by CHFI number one morning show host Maureen Holloway, who has been to like 50 or 60 countries and knows literally everything about getting the cheapest flights, getting there on time, navigating borders, doing the stuff that goes off the beaten path. So please check it out, and you can check out our other podcast there as well. And you can find us, The Big Story, at The Big Story FPN on Twitter, and of course at thebigstorypodcast.ca. And of course, all our shows are everywhere you get podcasts: Apple and Google and Stitcher and Spotify and Pocket Casts, and the list goes on. I'm Jordan Heath-Rellings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.